ahead and get started so we don't miss out on any time with our speaker. My name is Hannah Riley Bowles, and I'm the research director here at the Center for Public, the Women in Public Policy Program. We're focused here on closing gender gaps in the areas of economic opportunity, political opportunity, health, and education. And we are honored to have with us today Patricia Bowling, who's a professor of political science at Purdue University. And she is, her expertise is in comparative work family policy, bridging not only the U.S. and Europe, but also Japan. And this is what she's going to present today, is some research for a forthcoming book. So we're really excited and honored to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
And she has asked, actually, that we save questions until the end, unless it's a kind of burning question of clarification.
You know, I'm realizing they've got a camera on me. I may have to stay behind the podium in order to be photographed. Anyway, I want to say thank you for you coming.
It's only audio.
It's only audio, so you're all set.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. So you have freedom to wander.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm one of those people who does that. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for the invitation to speak. The work that I'm presenting today comes from a book manuscript, which I'm just beginning to feel like, yes, it's time to send it out to publishers. So this is a very nice time for me to have your questions and feedback. On a project that includes not just these three countries, France, Germany, and Japan, but also the United States. I decided not to talk about the U.S. Because of constraints of time, but I would be happy to take your questions if they have to do with American work-family policy, too. Obviously, I've done a lot of field work here, a lot of kind of qualitative interviewing with national-level ministry officials and experts in demography and so on. So about the best I can promise is that you will get a flavor for the kinds of arguments and evidence that I use, but I won't be able to make them with any sort of carefulness, just the nature of this kind of talk. Okay, so here's the plan. First, I'm going to talk about what low total fertility rates are and why they're important. Then I'm going to talk about the kind of dominant way that comparative work on low fertility countries and work family policies takes place, which is to look at best practices and to make policy recommendations on the basis of Sweden and France and so on. And then I'll take you through a very brief treatment of French, German, and Japanese work family policies, and I'll be using France as a kind of my version of ideal practices or the gold standard. And then talking about why Germany and Japan are not quite able to live up to the same expectations. And I think the reasons for that are important political reasons, and that's really the guts of what I have to say today. So what I want to do at the end is to draw some lessons from these case studies for understanding more generally social policy making and work-family policy making. So I won't be talking a lot today about a very arcane measure, total fertility rates. So total fertility rates is a demographic measure that is often counted, often publicized. It refers to the average number of children that a woman has in her lifetime. 2.1 is considered replacement level total fertility. Now, why am I going to spend time talking to you about total fertility rates? What exactly does total fertility rate, what are total fertility rates measuring? I think, of course, aside from looking at this as just the measure of the average number of children a woman has in her lifetime, total fertility rates are a well-chronicled measure of some of our most intimate decisions. Decisions about whether to have children, whether to continue pregnancies, whether to get married, whether to have careers, how many children to have, what our core satisfactions are. Do they have to do with raising children? Do they have to do with being well-established and productive in our careers? And talking about something like a total fertility rate measure can seem kind of bloodless. But it's a measure that represents aggregate decisions about some of the most important human satisfactions and pursuits. And it helps us understand how family formation, career development, child rearing, and value systems related to gender roles and traditional family arrangements are structured in different countries. So that's why we're paying attention to this particular measure. And I'm going to try to make it come alive for you. Obviously, what I've done is to choose three countries that for which low fertility is an issue. Now, it hasn't been such a burning issue in France for a very long time because France has been pretty successful with its work family policies. But in the 19th century, France was extremely pronatalist, and some of its policies continued to be so. And the reason was French people were having fewer kids, and lots of people were being ground up as cannon fodder in wars with Germany. And so France really wanted to promote encouraging people to have children and began to treat support for families and support for families with lots of children as a public state duty and obligation. So what's happened to total fertility rates over a period of 100 years or so? And if I could show you, if this could go way... I can't point, so I'll just have to gesture with my hands. If I could show you a graph that went back to the early 20th century, what you would see is the total fertility rates would be up here for all the OECD countries, all of the currently developed wealthy countries. And they've declined very steadily. They've declined for reasons that make good sense. Ever since people stopped being farmers and societies were not organized around agriculture but around wage-paying jobs in factories and the Industrial Revolution, there wasn't as much need to have children. And as women became better educated, they had fewer children. And children became took on a different valence. Instead of being free labor for your farm or for your enterprise, your family business, they became extra mouths to feed and extra people who would need to be supported through at least high school and probably college and God knows, maybe graduate school. And so children became a net liability, and people began to think very carefully about whether to have them and how many they wanted to have. There was, of course, a post-World War II baby boom, and fertility rates went up across the world. And then they began to decline pretty steadily and have done so since then, except in maybe the last decade or 15 years when they've rebounded slightly in countries like Sweden, the United States, let's see what else have I got up there in France, of course. But the two that you see that are steadily declining in the post-war era are Japan and Germany. And they're not the only ones that have been in decline. I'm sorry, I apologize for this tiny print, the tiny font. It's a little hard for you to read. But in that box on the right side of the slide, what you see are about 28 OECD countries arranged by total fertility rate. And the very lowest are Korea, Slovak Republic, Hungary, Poland, and so on. Includes Japan, includes Germany, includes Italy, includes Spain. And at the high end, you see Australia, Norway, France, Ireland, New Zealand, US, Iceland. So there's two distinctive clumps, the very low, lowest low fertility countries that are really kind of alarmed at the fact that if they continue as they are, they're very likely to be facing population decline, pretty significant population decline. If you have a total fertility rate, sustained total fertility rate of 1.3, then your population will decline by 75% in 100 years. And that's the kind of news that's pretty bracing for policymakers in countries like Japan and in Germany. So part of what people do when they're looking at these kinds of tables is to say, well, what accounts for the fact that some countries are doing so much better than others with respect to encouraging people to have more kids? And that's produced a discourse about, well, maybe there's something going on that low fertility countries need to learn from. And indeed, this slide, which is a kind of a complicated slide that I need to spend a minute with explaining, is a figure that was being circulated widely beginning in 2000. It appeared, for example, in Japanese government publications and in the OECD's A Caring World, the Employment Outlook, and the Babies and Bosses publications. And it's based on work by demographers, which was looking at the correlation between women's labor force participation and fertility rates. And along with what I said about the sort of general decline in total fertility from the 19th century onward, the broad trend is that the more women participate in the labor force, the fewer children they have. But long about the late 1990s, 2000, demographers began to notice a counter trend. And that was that for women who were born around 1960, the reverse seemed to be true. Countries that had high female labor force participation rates also had high total fertility rates. And the countries where women were not participating as robustly in the labor force had low total fertility rates. And you can see some nice treatments of this. For example, there's a wonderful comparison of the two cohorts in Iverson and Rosenblum's book, Women Work in Politics, which I'd be happy to share with you later. So given that there's this apparent set of success stories, a lot of work began to suggest that if the countries that are clustered here, low fertility countries, Spain, Germany, Japan, Korea, Poland, Italy, and so on. So basically what you see for low fertility countries is the Mediterranean Rim, Germany, the former Eastern Bloc, and Japan and Korea. And so the lesson seemed to be that those countries might take a leaf from the ones that were encouraging and making it easier for women to work if they wanted to increase their total fertility rates. And indeed, this slide shows you on the right side the Babies and Bosses publication from OECD. It was based on a study of, or several studies, of 13 OECD countries, resulted in four different publications. And that, along with cross-national comparative work on work-family policies by people like Gornick and Myers, pushed very hard on the idea of policy learning. That is, the idea that laggard countries could and should adopt the gold standard policies from Sweden, the other Scandinavian countries, and France. In particular, they recommended well-designed leave policies that are just right in length, that had some provision to encourage fathers to take some responsibility for child rearing and to interrupt their work lives, shorter work weeks, good, affordable child care and early childhood education, workplace policies that permitted parents to take part-time or flexible hours and to take time off, paid time off, when they needed to attend to sick children or appointments, avoiding exigent overtime and expectations of worker loyalty, or penalizing workers who interrupt their careers, and getting rid of tax systems and benefits that reward a male breadwinner stay-at-home or secondary earner system. So, those sorts of prescriptions, I want to talk more fully and will develop more fully why I think there's a little bit of miss with the idea that we can and should copy these examples. But this is to give you a sense for the kinds of policies adopted in three low fertility and three high fertility countries. The chart shows you a rough sketch of their child care, early childhood education, parental and maternity leave policies. So the first things you're seeing here are the female labor force participation rates for women of infants who are under age 2, women of preschoolers ages 3 to 5. And there's a little bit of a trend towards higher participation rates in the high fertility countries than in the lower fertility ones. And then if you look at the gender pay gap, you notice that there is a pretty substantial gender pay gap in Japan and a little higher than usual in Germany. If you look at formal care, you notice some pretty big discrepancies, especially Germany, with only 13.6% of young children who are in formal care.
Is the gender pay gap self-evident of all women or of women who are working?
I'll be talking about... gender pay gap for working women.
Okay.
Not including women who are not being paid. But including... Gender pay gaps are based on the assumption of full-time workers.
Okay.
So if you were to do a gender pay gap that looked at part-time workers versus full-time workers, it would be a very good comparison.
Okay.
One thing I've done is to take paid parental leave and done it in equivalent full pay weeks. OK, Okay, so if you actually look at the ways these things are set up, they're almost never fully paid. But if you want to compare them across countries, it's useful to change them into that kind of comparison. And then paternity leaves, which you can see the U.S. and Italy don't have any. France only has 2 weeks, and the other countries all have 2 months or 9 weeks. So what I want to do is to begin to talk about three countries in a little bit more detail. Let me start with France. You can see from this chart that France provides care to 43% of its children under the age of two, that does so through a system of public creche, as well as subsidies that help people pay for home care providers or nannies. At age 2.5, France has a system called École Maternelle, or kindergarten. And École Maternelle is part of the public school system. It has been since the late 19th century. It allows children to attend regular full day, the same as any school child's full day, and they don't have to pay anything. It's free. Most École Maternelle, especially in cities, offer a substantial amount of pre- and aftercare and can be used as a form of daycare for working parents. France, as you I'm sure all know, has a 35-hour work week. As I just said, it only offers about 2 weeks, 11 days of paid paternity leave. French maternity leave is, sorry, I do not mean maternity leave, and I'm gonna make this slip more than once. French parental leave is pronatalist in design. It offers 3 years of paid leave, paid at 534 euros a month, if you're having a second or subsequent child. If you're having a first child, then you get 6 months of paid leave. Parental leave in all countries is ostensibly gender neutral, that is, it's available to parents, it's called parental leave. But uptake is just hugely taken by women. 98% of those who take parental leave in most countries are women. So I'll slip sometimes, and I'll be talking about women and working mothers. And the reason is, overwhelmingly, despite the gender-neutral facade, most of these policies really are.
Can both parents take parental leave at the same time?
Sometimes. It depends on the country. I think more typically they do it sequentially.
One other question about the French leave. I mean, you said it's 500 some odd euros a month.
Right.
Which is not really enough for
right.
a family wage
right.
living situation.
Exactly.
So, okay.
And I'm going to talk about it.
Okay, great.
Yeah. I have to say, I think French policies, and this is after some considerable thought, seem to me largely uncontroversial. Gaullist parties support them. The Socialist parties support them. There are arguments about exactly what the mix should be, but there have been no sustained attacks on the basic structure of French family policy. One of the groups that is a key player, UNAF, is the National Union of Family Associations, and that's an umbrella organization of largely Catholic pro-family groups. I've tried to parse this out. I don't think this is like what we call family groups or, you know, sort of the family, pro-family lobby in the United States, but it is a somewhat conservative group of associations. They are clearly a player in work-family policy discussions and deliberations, but I would say a fairly enlightened one. Elite bureaucrats, demographers, experts have a lot of say in the family policy agenda in France. Feminists, on the other hand, really do not appear to be major participants in discussions about French family policy, except insofar as they're critical of it. And they are very critical of exactly the question you asked. What happens when we give women a 3-year leave paid at a very modest level? It tends to appeal to women who don't make very good wages, who think 500 euros looks pretty darn good, and if you're working in Monoprix as a checker, that's pretty unsurprising. And feminists have said, but what you're doing is encouraging women to take long repeated leaves. Their skills will atrophy and they will never get better paying jobs. You're really shunting women into dead-end jobs. And yet the government has not really responded to that except to say, yeah, but they choose it. It's fine. The other thing that I think feminists have been upset with is the 11 days of paid paternity leave. 2 weeks is not very much. It's not really enough to encourage fathers to be really very engaged with doing some of the work of unpaid work of raising their own children. And it's certainly not enough to encourage employers to view mothers and fathers, parents, gender neutral, as equally likely to interrupt their careers and therefore to kind of undermine gender-based discrimination. Turning to Germany, if you were to read the Burke family policy literature on Germany 15, 20 years ago, you would have been reading about a very traditional, very conservative country that approved of and had policies that supported male breadwinners. And they also had a long, low-paid leave policy. It was reimbursed at 300 euros a month. It was also 3 years. It applied to women who were not necessarily working. And then things changed. By the late 1990s, early 2000s, the discourse about their low fertility crisis was prompting a lot of worry. A couple of feminist publications came out in the mid-2000s which said, you know, if we really want to do something about that crisis, we've got to address the issue of working mothers. And we've got to make it possible for women to pursue careers, full-time careers, and to be able to take a brief leave, one of those just right leaves, and get back to work. And so in 2007, Germany adopted a Swedish-style parental leave law. And this is a startling law. They're giving people 67%, two-thirds of their usual wages, up to a cap of 1,800 euros a month. Which is to say, if they were paid up to 2,700 euros a month, they're covered. So well-paid workers are definitely being given incentives to have children. Low-paid workers, not so much, right? And along with that, Germany included 2 months of, everybody calls it, daddy leave. And the idea is men take it or they lose it. It cannot be added on to the parental leave. It is for the secondary partner. And the idea is to encourage men to be more engaged with their families. At the same time, the federal government promised to spend 8 billion euros in subsidies to the lender. And the idea was to encourage the lender, who have responsibility for early childhood education along with other education matters in the federal system of Germany, to expand and renovate childcare facilities so that after women took their 1 year of leave, there would be spaces available in full-time daycare for their children. And so the goal was to get enough coverage that 1 in 3 children under the age one and over would be able to attend childcare by 2014. But I have to say, I think as good as these policies sound on paper, I'm not sure that they're working out quite as well in reality. And here's one of the reasons. Obviously, this is a map from a German source. What is showing you is the 2011 figures for children age 3 and under who are attending formal childcare. And the lighter the shading, the fewer the number of children, and the darker the shading, the more. Okay. So what you see is a pattern whereby the former East Germany has very high coverage for children age 3 and under in childcare, whereas other parts of Germany, especially the far west and the south, have pretty low percentage coverage for children. And partly that has everything to do with the history of the two Germanys. Of course, the former socialist Eastern Germany expected and accommodated working mothers, and it's still taken for granted that mothers work, but that's okay. The former West did not. They really had a very strong ideology that if you were going to have kids, you should stay home and take care of them, by golly, and policies that were supportive of male breadwinner wages. Furthermore, think about this in terms of religious affiliation. Bavaria, right, strongly Catholic and strongly anti having lots of coverage for children to be in childcare. Whereas the Lutheran and secular parts of the country are much more okay with the idea that children should be cared for, there should be good childcare facilities. Okay, so part of the point of showing you this map is to address the issue of federalism, because I think that this is a key problem in Germany, that there's a federal state and they're doing their best to pull the levers and encourage compliance to really come up with adequate childcare facilities. But the main responsibility lays with the lender. And just as with the American states, when our federal government tells us, okay, now everybody needs to be in compliance with Medicaid or with civil rights, or you think of maybe gay marriage would be a good example, there is clearly going to be a huge gap. Some parts of the country will say, absolutely, let's do it right now, and others will drag their feet as long as possible, which I think is what's going on in Germany.
Excuse me. You know, I think it also raises the question of other policies feeding into and being harmonized with some of these early child care policies. I mean, I've heard a number of people from Germany in particular talk about, you know, the lunch breaks for school so that
give me a minute, and if I haven't answered that question adequately, then let's bring it up during the discussion, because I am going to talk about short school days. So, okay, if one of the problems that the prognosis for change in Germany is murky has to do with federalism, another one is that there's a very long-established history and evolved infrastructure that assumes that schools, and I don't just mean daycare centers, though, by the way, I'm told by authorities in Germany that daycare centers consider a six-hour day a full day, which is not the eight-hour day that a woman works if she's working a full day. But schools commonly begin quite early, 7:30-ish, and children are done with the school day at 1. They're expected to go home and eat lunch, and somebody's supposed to be at home feeding them lunch. There is if you watch German TV for 5 minutes, you're going to see advertisements for snacks for school. Frühstück, I think they're called. And the idea is that kids have to really put up with a fairly long morning with nothing to eat. So there's this whole snack industry. But it's not just the snack makers who are really organizing their lives around part-day school schedules. Anybody who has lived in Germany for a while is aware of the fact that you better get your grocery shopping done before 8 or so at night. You better stock up on bread on Saturday morning, because the stores are not going to be open on Saturday afternoon, and they're not going to be open all day Sunday. And there are whole groups of people who are clerks in shops and grocery stores, and there are unions who are very keen on keeping it this way, because they like the idea of having time with their own families and being able to be free from having obliged to work. Say the sorts of part-time and long hours that we expect our checkers to work in our 24/7 economy. And I think that kind of legacy has a lot of durability in Germany, and is part of the reason why one is unlikely to see the sorts of changes that, you know, magically the federal government is trying to whip up for precisely the reasons you were suggesting. So, family policies in Japan. Japan is aging very quickly. It's the fastest aging country in the world. And partly I think it's because Japanese people are extremely healthy and long-lived and have great health care, and partly because they have pretty low total fertility rates. And this reached a climax in the late 1980s when the total fertility rate reached 1.57, which was the same as it had been in an especially inauspicious year, the year of the fiery horses, where if you had a girl born that year, she would be unlucky, she would never manage to marry, and so people didn't have very many babies. And the total fertility rate, if you look at across time, it looks kind of like smooth curve, and then smooth curve. Well, they reached that point, that point, and everybody said, oh, what are we going to do? You know, this is not good. We're having a lot of problems. We can't even keep it above the fiery horse level. And of course, it's fallen much since that 1.57, which was what that level was, and is about 1.32 now. So Japan's done lots to try to address this, beginning with the Angel Plan, and the New Angel Plan, and the New Angel Plan, and several others that have equally fetching titles. Many of these programs were aimed at increasing the number of spaces in childcare and increasing the diversity of kind of childcare that Japan was offering. Japan in recent years has greatly expanded child allowances or family allowances, especially under the Democratic Party of Japan. It established in the early 90s a parental leave. At first it was not a paid leave, but it then was gradually increased and has been reformed until now. It pays a worker 50% of their usual wages and includes 2 months of partner days or daddy days, also reimbursed at 50% of usual wages. But despite all that, the policies haven't been very successful, and again, I think the reasons are political ones. Okay. Imagine an ideology about the welfare state in Japan that is a little bit like that in the United States. Welfare state? I don't like welfare states. I don't want to spend more taxes so poor people can have an easy ride. No, it's not quite the animus against poor people, okay? But there is a lot of kind of pride in the fact that Japan is a lean, mean, not high-spending welfare state that takes care of things through private employment-based welfare plans, that is not a big spender, and attempts to increase taxes, which everybody I talk to says to me, you want to be able to have more spaces in childcare, you want to really expand these systems so they're workable, and you get rid of the waiting list of people who are trying to get their kids into childcare, you're going to have to increase taxes because it's going to cost money, serious money. And the kind of tax increase they talk about is an increase in consumption tax. That's a sales tax. It's an across-the-board sales tax. And Japanese voters have been pretty punitive towards anybody who has suggested, okay, it's time to pass the tax increase. And so they're kind of stuck between a hard rock and a hard place. They know they need more money to make the policies they've enacted workable, but they're not able to fund them. And there's a lot of resistance to the increase in taxes that would make that possible. But a second and more important argument, I think, has to do with an established long-standing policy repertoire in Japan of relying on administrative guidance, that is, laws that set goals and aim to educate and persuade corporate actors, and it is usually corporate actors, by the way, to go along with them. And those kinds of laws do not have penalties. There's no fine. There's no chance of somebody who feels aggrieved bringing a lawsuit. They are simply depending on a form of persuasion. And in fact, there have been debates where pro-labor groups have said, look, let's put some teeth in these laws, and they've lost. And part of the reason for that is the kinds of policy discussions and deliberations that result in policy change in Japan occur in deliberative councils or shingikai. And in the shingikai, various parties are invited to the table. And those parties always include big business and small business and labor. But the privileged position in the discussion especially goes to business. And business was able, when there was a discussion about setting up a parental leave, to say, okay, fine, we'll have a 1-year parental leave, we'll have job protected leaves, no problem, just so long as you make sure it's not enforceable. And indeed, it has stayed that way. And I think part of the reason it's so difficult to adopt rigorous, enforceable laws in Japan is because there's a climate where big business representatives are always key political and policy actors. And this continues to be true even since the Democratic Party of Japan has come into power in the late 2000s. I want to get technical on you for just a moment and talk about the political economy of the labor market. And what I mean here is Japan has a particularly tough labor market for working mothers. And the reason it's such a tough market is that it's based on skill, on firm specific skills. And so people are likely to be hired to a big company in Japan, and the company will invest a fair amount of time and money in educating their new hirees into the way things are done at Mitsubishi or Honda or wherever. And because they invest a lot of money in firm-specific skills acquisition, they don't want to hire people unless they're pretty darn sure they're going to stick around and not be taking leaves. And that is especially difficult for anybody who thinks they want to take time off to raise children. And employers who are averse to and who have very punitive policies with respect to employees who take a significant amount of time off are pretty hard on people who need to take some time off because they're having babies and spending some time at home raising them. So that kind of political economy is a huge elephant in the room in Japan that is largely not discussed, never mind any effective efforts to try to do something about it, like requiring employers to get rid of this kind of you know, idea that workers have to be incredibly loyal or they're not worth investing in. Another approach that countries can take to this, Sweden has taken, and that is to develop woman-friendly jobs in the public sector. And that might also be an approach that Japan could take but has not seriously considered. Okay, so somebody asked me a little bit earlier about gender gaps. And this is a graph that was published in December 2012 in the New York Times. And what it shows you is the gender gap for childless women, those are the blue bars, and the gender gap between mothers and male workers. And of course, what I want you to notice is the country that has the largest gap between mothers and male workers is Japan. And what that represents is, okay, 62% gap. Mothers are making 38% as much as men. That's an enormous gender gap. It's an enormous mommy penalty. And it represents the problem of the political economy and the way that the labor force is organized in Japan very tellingly, I think. So, last couple points about Japan. I wanted to just say that one of the reasons Japan manages to have a very small conventional welfare state is because it does rely on privately provided employment-based welfare benefits, including things like the dependent spouse allowance. Now, the dependent spouse allowance is given to a breadwinner earner, and the assumption is that his spouse, his wife, will not make over $10,000 a year. And if she makes more than that, then you don't get the dependent spouse allowance anymore. And it's structured in such a way that it's a strong incentive for women to take part-time and low-paid jobs. Clearly, when you have that kind of measure available as part of your private welfare system, it undermines a lot of what the government's trying to do with its pronatalist policies. By way of summing up, Japan is facing a situation where young people are finding it harder to launch. Harder to find good jobs that will allow them to pay for their own apartment or house, and get married, and have children. Many are postponing marriage, which in a country where birth almost always occurs within marriage is one sure way to make sure that the fertility rates are low. Women in Japan are faced with a harsh either-or choice, career or family, but you can't do both. Work-family policies are not getting at the heart of the problem in Japan, which is the work side of work-life policies, because workplace regulations or anti-discrimination laws are either ineffective or impossible to pass. Nor have women's groups or feminist organizing been effective in pushing for change, and young women are not vocal participants in the policymaking process. So, what are the larger lessons from this study of four countries for thinking about how to do comparative work-family policymaking work? First thing I want to say is that the prior approach, and what I think is still pretty much the dominant approach to looking at comparative work-family policies, which is based on typologies and ideal types, and the idea that there are the good countries and they're doing it right, and then there are the laggard countries and they need to learn from the good countries. There's something, I think, profoundly wrong about this approach, because I think it's assuming that it's possible to do policy work. It's simply a question of will, right? You know what works, just get with the program and do it. But no country starts with a blank slate. Instead, they're all faced with the accumulated approaches to family support policymaking or not, to constellations of political power and to political institutions and processes that favor some policy approaches over others. And because they're not blank slates, some of them have enormous difficulty. Can you imagine the U.S. really being Sweden? I mean, that's one way to think about this. And it's not any more likely that Japan will be either. A second point, work-family policies do matter, but women's labor force participation rates and patterns matter even more. Women and mothers are disproportionately shunted into low-paid part-time work in countries like Germany and Japan, where those rates are 39 and 41% respectively. And both countries have substantial gender wage gaps. Countries need to do more than provide good child care and paid parental leave. They need to address the labor market because women's decisions about their ultimate satisfactions in life, whether that be kids or careers or some mix, are shaped by how high the opportunity costs they pay are for interrupting their careers to have children. And that means paying attention to things like specific versus general skills regimes, because they make a huge difference to women's ability to interrupt their careers and return to good jobs after breaks for childbearing. States can establish women-friendly policy. Public sector jobs in Sweden has done, and they can try to address the workplace gender and pregnancy discrimination issues as the U.S. has done, but ignoring the issue will not make it go away. Institutional capacity. Just on the face of what we've seen today, federal systems and political structures that have lots of veto points are going to have a tougher time enacting effective national policies, which I think is the federalism question, especially is true of Germany and the U.S. And conversely, countries that have elite, influential national-level bureaucrats can be powerful forces. Those bureaucrats can be powerful forces for policy change. Policy repertoires are durable, and they're shaped by decisions that are made early in the process. You can see this, for example, with France's establishment in the 1920s of the family funds, which exist today and are still a very strong force lobbying for a continuation in the way that France administers its family policies. You can see it with that German, very resilient kind of desire to have a part-time school day, which made a lot of sense when kids needed to come home and work in farms and do their chores, and arguably doesn't make very much sense in the 21st century. And you can certainly see it with the Japanese preference for administrative guidance. Finally, powerful actors matter. And that would, of course, include big business in most countries. The National Union of Family Alliances in France. But interestingly, the powerful interests in this group are not always going to include feminists and women's movements. And I think that's something that is probably worth our discussing a little bit. So with that, let me invite your questions.
I'm Emilia, I'm a PhD student here. I'm from France. So
oh, wonderful.
I have many grateful things to say about your presentation of France being probably one of the best.
Oh, that's why you were smiling when I said that.
I am already a mother, and so I can have some experience about what you say. I think something you also could have on the system is from the tax system, where all this thing is designed so that your third child does not cost you anything,
right?
Because the tax system makes it, you pay so less taxes with a third child versus a second. All the incentive is really on the third child.
Again, a very pronatalist design.
And I think it's also an incentive for women to have higher wages, because you know that through the tax system, if you have children, and if you have three children, in fact, you have a lot of benefits. So I think the chart I like to show on this topic is public spending for family policy and fertility rate. France is spending 4% of GDP in family policy. And you can have a very clear correlation among European countries.
Absolutely. One might also compare the quotient familial with income splitting in Germany, which supports a very different notion of families, right, the married couple. But that's a point very well taken. And, of course, this is a book, right? And believe me, I talk about taxes, too. I could only deal with one heavy topic in this lecture.
But my point is that there are many side policies that are not exactly designed. If you just look from outside, you don't see this, but I think for many French families, most of them being in a high-end income part of the population, population, you see very large families, not because they're Catholic, because just tax-wise, it's wise for many children.
And you're absolutely right. It makes a huge difference if you're not penalizing families, higher income families, for having more children, which is pretty common in other policy designs.
So, I mean, I think that point raises important questions about how this plays out then in the labor force participation of women, and particularly women being able to move into leadership positions and decision-making positions. Do you have some of that information for France?
Glass ceiling kinds of issues, for example, how many women, what's the percentage of women in management level jobs? I do know a little about that.
Management.
And it might surprise you to know that the U.S. is probably the best in the world.
The U.S. is
in that regard.
It's 45%, but not at the top.
There is no country doing better than us with respect to breaking through glass ceilings. And if I were to speculate as to why, I think it partly has to do with the relatively unregulated labor market in the U.S., the idea that talent is recognized, and the relative mobility for women and flexibility for women to return from taking time off if they do take some time off to have kids and be rehired into good positions. But France is not exemplary with respect to women in leadership positions, and certainly not Japan and not Germany. So I don't know the heart of what you're trying to ask.
What I'm thinking about is the implications of the kind of research you're doing for our understanding, you know, being able to look at the trajectories of women's working lives.
Well, then,
and leadership participation.
Okay, all right. Maybe we need to have a sidebar conversation about this, but my guess is that if we're thinking about most women and what their opportunities are to lead satisfying, fulfilling lives and do important work, that's a different question than how many of them are becoming top leaders, which tends often to be women who are childless or, you know, who've had nannies and not had to deal with the hands-on part of children very much. We're back.
Yeah, I guess sort of the first thought that comes to my mind is, you know, when you're looking at the French system, you're looking at a system that was created, I don't know if it was necessarily created to benefit the mothers, but, you know, for these other sort of pronatalists and creating a national identity, perhaps, reasons. And when you're comparing that to systems that are much newer and much more, you know, they have a lot of other motives going on, and I think the French was probably more straightforward and not necessarily about the women per se, versus, you know, something like Germany, where you're looking at a patchwork of a federalist system that has a lot of different motivating factors going on, and also a very entrenched patriarchy. I get this is sort of a roundabout way of getting to my comment, but do you think that it's really about the women, or do you think that it's about the nation building in terms of getting a structure in place to get the women working and get the kids together?
That's a great question. And so is a little sub-comment about patriarchy. With respect to France, I think you're right. And I guess I would say it seems to me that Japan is kind of really concerned with losing national prestige and economic productivity. And that's one of the big reasons why it's attending to the issue of lowest low fertility. Not because they're all that concerned with women per se, because women are not driving this policy change. It's rather a kind of concern about national prestige. Having said that, I think they're not drawing very smart lessons about what would really make a difference. And I think that has to do with you know, kind of very kind of sticky, difficult things that are hard to push past, like the power of big business and their notions of, you know, wanting to keep a kind of specific skills regime in place that penalizes women. But the question about patriarchy, you notice that I didn't talk a lot about cultural values. And I left out one of my favorite stories, which is the Robin Butcher story. Robin Mütter is a word that's used to talk about working mothers. It's a German word, obviously. And you can probably tell Robin Mütter means raven mother, raven mothers. And the idea is that any woman who would go back to work with small children is like a nasty crow who just tosses her chicks out of the nest and goes about her business. And it's still used. It's still used in parts of Germany and in situations where I thought people would be much more circumspect. So I think that there is still a very durable undercurrent of the expectation that good mothers engage in intensive mothering. They, of course, they stay home with their children, and then if they do go back to work, they certainly not work more than part-time, which all of these countries have some patriarchy, but maybe you can say more so in Germany and Japan than France.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I just sort of had the particular dig at Germany because one of my best friends from grad school has had a very, she's not German, she's from the U.S., but her husband is German, and then went back to Germany for his job, and she has had a very, very difficult time getting into the German labor force, period, with, you know, outstanding credentials and without children.
So. And she speaks good German.
Good enough. Not, you know, I mean, she would be fine in a working environment.
Yeah.
So, I have two questions. The first one is, did you look at... I have two questions. The first one is, did you look at the difference between married woman and non-married woman for the child fertility? The reason of it is, in France, there is an increasing number of not getting married for tax purposes, and that increased the number of child rate per woman. Mm-hmm. So that's also one question that I have. The other thing is, it's more difficult to find in France social category differences, but the number of child per woman is more likely to happen in lower social category than higher educated women. And the main reason of it, I mean, there is a report of the French government on that on Public Health explaining that women with higher education are more likely to postpone their pregnancy and having their child later on, mm-hmm. when they have more financial stability than younger and less educated.
You know better than I do, probably, that French data that look at ethnic and class origins are pretty hard to find.
I'm French, though. I know, yeah, that, no, I know how difficult it is.
However, of course, I'm aware that France, Sweden, the United States all have very high out-of-wedlock birth rates, all have pretty high rates of cohabitation, that is, living together with your partner without being married. And some speculate that countries that are more liberal with respect to family form and tolerant of non-traditional families are likely to have higher fertility rates.
But my, okay, maybe I can make my point across the table. There is a report that came out like 6 months ago about the number of children born in France, and more than 60,000 of them, we don't know where they are coming from. So there is also things that are at the intersection of women coming in and taking advantage or not of the system we have. And I think it's a point fair to make, because you will have a lot of people reacting in France about that.
Absolutely. I am aware that there are ways in which single mother-headed, low-income families can be well taken care of in the French social security system. And I think that France has seemed to me to be largely tolerant and accepting of, you know, as long as kids are born into the world, the French state is going to support them.
There is a change, I think.
Okay, let's exchange cards and talk about this in more detail, because it sounds to me like you probably could tell me about sources I need to know about.
Thank you very much. I was particularly taken with your statement that no country has a blank slate, and wanted to talk a little bit about the power of the economy, because I have been a visiting professor in Japan, China, Germany, England, and I think for what's relevant for your talk is I was in Japan and China at the times when Japan was powerful and rich, and I was attacked by the State Department for giving away too much of this country because the Japanese were coming and cherry-picking our ideas. Although my work wasn't then specifically on women in Japan, if you had asked me then, in the 80s,
field is science and technology policy, so I would talk with the National Academy of Engineers, and every young assistant professor, woman of engineering, would come up and say, I've got to talk to you. And then the economy tanked, and we're getting these figures, which are so totally different from what I saw. In China, when I was first there, 86, 87, they were poor, and the women were poor. And now you're beginning to get a real sense of change. I went back just a couple of years ago and met women leaders, and it's awesome. So I think the economy is a very important variable to keep in mind when you're thinking, what should the public policy be? Now, let me throw just a small spanner into the works to think of a parallel null hypothesis, which is what I was thinking of as you were speaking. What if we decided it's not such a good idea to have more children, and that we shouldn't be spending this money on getting families to have more children? The planet can't support them, the environment is gone, and in this very building, everybody's writing these books that say, the end of work, there are no more jobs. If you look at what's going on in this country, we're building three enormous new plants, but we're not going to hire any people. Robots are going to be doing all the work, and we'll have a small administrative staff. So it seems to me, in parallel with the work you're doing, you might be questioning whether or not that's where the emphasis in government should be. Now, I know there are lots of problems, because other countries you haven't mentioned are reproducing at rapid rates, and everybody gets nervous about that. But I think it's not such a bad idea to think through, what if it's a very, very different employment scene?
You ask a terrific set of interesting observations and questions. And it is a completely different employment scene. And, you know, what are people to do if we all of a sudden had a big birth rebound mm-hmm. in Japan? Are there really going to be more good jobs for them? Evidently not. Because the Japanese economy is having a tough time ever since the lost decade of the 1990s that you're referring to, with having, for Japan, pretty high unemployment rates and problems with making sure that people who graduate from college or high school end up in good regular jobs. And in a system where that makes all the difference, when young people don't get hired into good jobs, they don't have very wonderful lives. They work, you know, work as checkers at 7-Eleven, and that's not a great place to end up. And they don't end up, you know, feeling like they have it, the capacity to find a girlfriend or find a boyfriend and settle down and have a couple kids. And of course, you know, environmentalists and lots of other people say, nothing wrong with the idea of shrinking populations in wealthy countries. High time. So I certainly take your point. Remember that, perhaps it's not obvious, but the reason I come to this is because I'm interested in policies to support working mothers,
yep.
because I think they're important.
Absolutely.
And so demographic crisis for me becomes one of the ways that countries identify this as something that requires a response. And so from that point of view, the null hypothesis is one that I certainly take as important, but it's not because I want to look at work-family policies. And justice for women, that's my reason for coming at this.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My interest is parenting education, and I wonder if you could say something about children's well-being and access to other supports for families, as well as including in that supports highly paid part-time work. Why does part-time work have to be poorly paid? Is it job sharing? And what do you find most hopeful, if anything?
That's good.
Work?
Okay, so she had me all primed for this because she told me before I started talking, I'm interested in parenting education. I don't know all that much about parenting education. That's something I think you could probably tell us about. But I am, of course, familiar with ideas and arguments about how important it is for all children to get a good start. And that's kind of an argument for high quality early childhood education, kindergartens, preschools, and high quality childcare, meaning regulated childcare where people have to be trained, where there are acceptable ratios of teachers to children that are based on age and need. And there are lots of lessons in this. I didn't talk about the United States today, but the United States badly needs that kind of regulation because we're we're so blithe about, well, we're a free market system and there's all kinds of child care to be purchased, but it's a lot of it is you get what you pay for. It's not very high quality, although it's pretty cheap. And that's not, in my view, a very acceptable solution, because it leaves so many people behind and it increases social inequalities. Now, you also ask about good part-time jobs, and I think the Netherlands is a good example of this. Part-time jobs don't have to be bad jobs. They are bad jobs in Germany and Japan, but they don't have to be. And I think the Netherlands is one of the countries that people really should be observing, because part-time work is probably a great solution for parents, gender neutral, men and women, who could maybe have segments of their life where they're working part-time.
And be there for their children.
And be there for their children. Exactly.
There was a USA Today Spotlight survey that most parents want more time with their children. And I'm guessing that most children want more time with their parents.
Yeah.
Parents
are at the table on the way.
Yeah, 5 years old. Don't walk to the store.
Anybody else?
My question would be, I'm German, and you mentioned our dearly held concept of a raven mother. I regret that, by the way. So my question would be, how can policy change culture, and if not, to what extent can a country change its culture at all? Because in a last year, the Federal Institute for Population Research published a study about preferences of Germans of childbearing age, and when they had to rank their jobs, their friends, their hobbies, and their families and children, they ranked it exactly this way, in this order. So, so I'm wondering, what can policy actually do about it?
Yeah. I don't think policy can change culture. I think culture is one of those parts of being not a blank slate. It is there, and you have to work with it. Now, having said that, I do think culture can and does change, albeit pretty slow. So, you know, when you think about it, the United States, maybe 40 years ago, also had a pretty blaming culture about working mothers. And yet it's changed dramatically. And I think it's changed in part because there were, you know, some role models, some women, exemplary women who went out and did it all, and who we started to see as something to admire, not something to despise. Also because of economic need. You know, really, how were people going to support their families if the wives didn't work? Or if moms were single moms and they had to support their families? And I wouldn't say it's disappeared entirely in this country either. But it does at least suggest to me that when other things are pushing the need to accept women in the workforce, culture can change. It can change fairly quickly. Not on a dime, that's for sure. And you know, you must have heard the stories about Ursula von der Leyen, the ministry,
yeah.
The minister. Okay, so this woman is a family minister under Angela Merkel. And she was the architect for these big changes that occurred in 2007. And she has 7 children. And that's what everybody knows about her. Which, you know, little by little, the Ursula von der Leyen's are probably going to have some small effect, right? Even in Germany. And Germany's not monolithic. You know that as well as I do. That is, there is already a lot of acceptance of the idea of working mothers in parts of Germany. So, this is a debate we would. By the way, I need you to give me the site to the Demographic Institute.
Sure.
Okay. Because it sounds like a winner. Sounds like one I really want to read.
Yeah.
But you know, I guess I would urge you not to think about culture as something that's like a brick wall. But, or maybe a brick wall, but one that's starting to crumble a little bit. Maybe that's a better image.
Kathleen Benhut, I'm also German. I work for the International Herald Tribune. I have a couple of questions. I mean, I would really love to just hear something about the United States. We haven't really talked about it. In particular, you talk about this relationship between female employment rates and sort of childcare facilities. In other words, countries that make it possible for working moms to have full-time jobs. Usually you have a positive relationship between fertility rates and female employment rates. That relationship, to my knowledge, is not as evident in the United States, where you don't have those childcare facilities. between how the welfare state makes it possible mm-hmm. for women to be in work. As soon as you have a welfare state that does that, you have high fertility rates and high female to work rates.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, you don't have that policy structure, and yet you do have very high fertility rates, to my understanding, and I would love to know more.
Okay, so you're sort of setting up a tension that I usually spend some time setting up, which is, look at the U.S., what an anomaly. It has high total fertility rates and female labor force participation rates, but very little in the way of infrastructure and state support, welfare state support for work-family policies. But that's not to say we don't have child care. Of course we do. It's kinder care. It's the rocking horse. It's the lady down the street who doesn't have a green card. It's, you know, the church, you know, the daycare center that is housed in a church on the weekdays. And it's informal and market-driven, and there's lots of it, and it varies tremendously in quality. We do very little in this country to support financially the amount that people have to pay for childcare, and that cost can be pretty hefty, as I'm sure many of you could attest to. So that doesn't mean that people don't put their children in some kind of care. They do. And if they don't have very well-paying jobs, they go looking for the cheapest possible alternatives, which are generally not very high quality. But just because there's no state infrastructure doesn't mean we don't have daycare. Francis Castles would say, oh, what really matters is the supply of daycare. Where it comes from doesn't matter.
Right, but just to follow up, I mean, in some of the southern European countries, you have very low fertility rates, and you do have that very much more informal sort of infrastructure of childcare as well. But there, women make a choice. They either decide to have children and kind of look after them, or they actually decide to have a career, but not really. So I'm interested in where that drive comes from that U.S. women seem to have to, I mean, because it is hard, right? It is very hard to have your children looked after in this country. It's expensive. Even if it's informal, it's difficult. You know, it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And so there must be something, maybe in the culture, that is different from Europe.
Okay,
you know
so
I mean?
One thing that's different from, say, Spain or Greece or Portugal, I don't know about Italy. The one thing that's different is it's easier to get into a job in the United States than it is in those countries. If you are an up-and-coming woman who wants to have a good career job in a Mediterranean Rim country, you might spend 5 or 10 years finding it and working at part-time jobs until you finally get your dream job that is really what you were hoping for. And those 5 or 10 years might occur between the ages of 25 and 35. So by the time you've got it and you're ready to think about launching, okay, now, you know, a lot of academic women in the U.S. will tell you the same story, right? Wait till I get my first job, wait till I get tenure. And of course, by that time, the chances you're going to be fertile enough to have kids are diminished. So this is not an unheard of tension in this country. Sorry. but I think the economy, the labor market, is quite different in the U.S., and that's the reason, not a cultural explanation, but really a sort of pragmatic reason that women find it easier to get into jobs, to take time off if they need to or want to get back into jobs. Whereas I think the Mediterranean Rim and most of the low-fertility countries have very significant barriers to being able to continue career-level engagement with the workplace.
I think interacting with that probably also would be different levels of welfare. So like in the U.S., TANF is so time-limited.
Five lifetime.
You
right.
will work, right? Or you don't survive, right? And so, you know, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, that's also a good point.
Work.
Right. Whereas you might be out of the workforce because you can afford to be in a country with more generous people for that.
Yeah. Okay.
Anybody else?
You made mention at the end of the need for big business to be a player and the opportunity to discuss that more. You talked about in Japan, they had rules but no punishment for big business. Are there any incentives that you're seeing, incentives to big business to make family-friendly policy, things that you're encouraged by, maybe early adopters of policies, big business?
That's a really good question. And there is a whole literature about kind of informal ways that states encourage employers to be family-friendly. And Japan, in fact, is using those kinds of techniques very heavily, in part because you know, that they don't want to do the kind of the hard law that's enforceable that allows a lawsuit, but they will use soft, persuasive law. And the incentives that seem to me to be a really good idea, I haven't seen very widely adopted. For example, let's say that you gave a tax break to an employer who built an on-site daycare center and or provided a sizable amount, a sizable sum to help their employees pay for childcare. Now, tax breaks, that's the way that American policy gets made. That is an approach we often take in this country. But I don't think there is much in the way of such encouragement. You may recall 2 months ago when President Obama gave his second inaugural address, no, sorry, State of the Union address. He said, I really would like to see us adopt a universal pre-K educational system. And I think what he was talking about was a little bit like those federal incentives to the lender that I was talking about in Germany. You know, a federal program whereby states that are innovators, that are really pushing to adopt a good universal pre-K system would get some federal funds to help them do that. Now, I think that's absolutely dead on arrival. I don't think it's going anywhere. I'm glad he talked about it, but, you know, and it's not quite pertinent to what you're asking, which is more about incentives to employers. But I think that idea is talked about, and France and Germany also, as well as Japan, are using different ways of encouraging businesses to adopt pro-family policies. And I think they especially are interested in trying to get businesses to allow parents to take part-time schedules without penalizing them for doing that, allow them to be able to have some flexibility about start and finish times or work days, and especially allowing them a little bit of flexible paid time off to take care of their kids. But exactly what those incentives are for getting employers to do that, I'm not real clear.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
Are you seeing any competitive advantage or any businesses using competitive advantages by using those? I mean, we just saw Yahoo and Best Buy change their whole work from home. I was curious that we didn't see some opportunity for them to say, but here's some flexibility for the advantage of your family. Are you seeing anyone? I mean, it would have really changed their news a good bit.
Yeah, that's good. That's right.
Have you seen anyone using that as a
competitive advantage? Oh, sure. If you were to follow the Working Mothers, that's a magazine.
Yes, I wouldn't have known that.
The Working Mothers yearly poll for most family-friendly businesses. There is a ranking for the top 100 best places to work if you are a working mother. And that gets discussed a lot and brought up in academic articles and also in journalistic kinds of treatments. And I think that the whole idea is that people do want to attract high-level, very well-trained workers and keep them and make sure they're loyal. And to do that, they will offer things like paid leaves that go well above and beyond our Family Medical and Leave Act, right? Our tremendous 12 weeks of unpaid leave in this country. And yes, they're competing, and they do so pretty self-consciously. What surprised me is that after Best Buy and Yahoo announced that they would no longer allow workers to telecommute, is that there weren't any kind of background pieces that addressed precisely this issue and your question. Because I do think, in fact, there are especially high-tech companies that are pretty competitive with respect to offering good. I mean, it only affects maybe tiny, tiny 7% of the American population who work for really good employers. But they do compete, and they do so, you know, fully cognizant that they want the best of the brightest to stay with them.
I think we really only have time for some closing comments. Are there any other...
Oh boy!
I didn't put it on you.
Maybe just spring this on me, right?
Yeah, yeah. No. Well, I'll tee it up. I mean, any other highlights that you would compare from the American example? Yeah.
I think you probably can intuit that my take on the American approach to work family policy is that it's very underdeveloped, and you know that experientially, many of you. We don't do much in the way of formal welfare state policies to begin with, and we certainly don't do much with respect to paid parental leaves, job-protected paid parental leaves, regulating the quality, either at the state or the federal level, of child care, encouraging really fine early childhood education. And so the U.S. is an interesting counterpoint to the other three countries. I mean, The other thing one can say is that women do pretty well in terms of gender gap and in terms of being able to break through glass ceilings. I know that sounds odd, but compared to the other three, they do better. And the dynamism of the American market is both a kind of bane and something that people will say, well, you know, so American women are able to do better in some respects than women elsewhere. So a bunch of puzzles here, and I appreciate all of you asking me questions that sort of illuminated some of the country-specific ones a little more fully. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was terrific. Thank you very much.